Why this book now for you? Is there something about the time period, something that you see this country going through that made you think this is a book we need to begin discussing and these are ideas that we need to put on the table?
When I published Unsafe at Any Speed, Exposing the Auto Industry on the Issues of Safety and Pollution in 1965, it got a lot of attention, including in Congress. There were members of Congress like Senator Ribicoff, Senator Nelson, Senator Magnuson, who took the findings, had congressional hearings. We passed legislation in 1966, signed by Lyndon Johnson, and it saved well over a million lives and many more injuries as motor vehicles got safer. You can't do that today. The decay of the political culture, the concentration of the media on celebrity sports, trivia, are orders of magnitude different than 1966. There is no Phil Donahue show. You can't get on the afternoon TV shows now, which are devoted to sadomasochist or sexual programs, personal development at the best. You can't do that. We used to get on serious topics on entertainment shows like Mike Douglas, Merv Griffin, that were into 300 markets all over the country. So now we got to step back and say, look, what's happening to us as a society? Where is our civic culture? Why have we given our power to forces that concentrate it in Washington and Wall Street and then use it against us via the corporate state or the corporate government? And that's what the 17 solutions is addressing. We've got to start thinking about solutions that are long overdue, that don't disrupt the rhythm of American cultural life. They are consonant with it and have a high majority of support, what Abraham Lincoln called the public sentiment. Because we live in an age of massive muckraking books about corporate and government abuses. They're coming out 10, 20 times more frequent than they were 40 years ago. This is the golden age of expose documentaries about the Iraq War and Afghanistan and Wall Street and contaminated water and so on. And less is occurring compared to when there were far fewer books and documentaries 40 years ago, which generated action. Because we had, believe it or not, and I don't want to idealize it, we had a more functioning democracy in those ways. You could actually get things through Congress. You could actually get regulations on health and safety and environment that were reasonably enforced. Now we're facing a disintegrating situation where jobs are being exported in the millions to communist fascist countries abroad, where the standard of living is declining for the majority of the American people, where there's chronic unemployment, and where the rich escape their fair share of taxes along with corporations. So these 17 solutions are really quite appropriate. A category is you realign the public budget. So you take down the bloated military budget. You have fundamental tax reform, which increases taxes on the corporate and the wealthy. Many corporations like Verizon and General Electric have paid no federal income tax in recent years, and you crack down on corporate crime, applying the fines, which will be in the billions of dollars. You get corporations off welfare. That's about $200 to $300 billion a year. You apply a Wall Street speculation tax, which is tremendously supported around the country, and you take that money and you give it back to the people in the form of lower taxes, but more tangentially, public works programs that repair and modernize America's public services, schools, clinics, libraries, public transit, dams, roads, bridges, underground, the sewage and drinking water systems. These are in huge states of disrepair. You put that money back, you improve the life of the American people, you create good-paying jobs that can't be exported to China. So that's an example of a cluster of solutions that people can mobilize around and get through Congress. And one of the solutions is, how do you get enough people mobilized in every congressional district to turn Congress around, which is the go-to branch in terms of constitutional power, having the taxing power, spending power, war declaration power, investigative power, you name it. If you turn those 535 men and women who put their shoes on every day, like you and I do, around, you turn the government around, you turn the country around.
One part of this book is looking at the media and what the media is doing right now. You mentioned that this is the era of exposés, of documentaries. But in this book, one of the things you argue is that journalists will do these great investigative pieces, but they offer no solutions to the problems that are going on. Do you think that the media should be playing a role in terms of being more of an activist or providing solutions or just coming up with different proposals for the different problems you see in society right now?
Well, Jonathan, there are ways, you know, to deal with traditional reporting obligations. I mean, if 60 Minutes comes up with a great expose, say, on the student loan racket, which they did, they just leave people hanging at the end. People saying, oh, my goodness, look at this horrible thing, exploiting students, Sallie Mae, government subsidies and guarantees for Sallie Mae. They don't extend it. Well, how would they extend it without actually being partisan? Well, one is they could talk about people who are actually doing things in the civic culture about Sallie Mae. Another is they could give references. They could give websites at the end. But instead, they leave people hanging. And that's true for television. It's true for radio investigative reports, such as they are. And it's true of the print media. When Michael Moore came out with his documentary Sicko, which did very well in the theaters, after getting people really riled up and showing how many people die as a result of not being able to afford health insurance, 800 a week, by the way, in the United States, to get diagnosed and treated, where does he leave the viewers in the theaters? He's taking up his laundry up the steps of the U.S. Capitol. He left them hanging. And this is a real activist, Michael Moore. So you can see that the pattern in investigative journalism is tell people what they need to know that they don't know, even name names. But for heaven's sake, don't lead them to where they can do something about it. Or after the expose, 2, 3, 4 weeks later, somebody actually does something, like file a good lawsuit or mobilize a rally. There's no follow-up. The Washington Post, the New York Times, they do not follow up their exposés, largely because they're looking for Pulitzer Prizes. They're looking for features rather than on-the-ground daily reporting.
One of the solutions that you write about is interesting. You call it give science and technology back to the people. Tell me a little bit about what you mean by that.
Yeah, well, you know, most science and technology now is in two categories: military weapons research and development. That's huge, as we know. That's a big part of the Pentagon budget. It absorbs a great many brilliant scientists and engineers in analyzing, producing, testing weapons of mass destruction in a world where we have no major enemy left. We may have criminal gangs, but no more Soviet Union, no more communist China military threat. The other source is absorbed by corporations. They hire a lot of scientists and engineers, often to produce harmful things like hazardous medicines, toxic chemicals, or to produce trivia. I mean, there are actual chemists who are working as we speak in the food processing industry trying to get a particular whip to put on bakery products or to put on desserts. These are people with PhDs. So this chapter said, what about science and technology for the people? Why don't we have at least as good public transit systems and trains as the Japanese and Western Europeans have? Why don't we develop systems that can reduce the horrendous death toll in hospitals from hospital-induced infections? The Centers for Disease Control estimates it at about 250 deaths a day from hospital-induced infections. Why don't we develop the kind of tools that people can use, do it yourself, better tools than exist now, to replace the very expensive systems now that have to be repaired because they're designed, if not to fail in an abbreviated time, they're designed not to be repaired. You have to buy the whole product all over again. It's a throwaway society. So there's a lot of examples in this chapter, and it's the chapter 3, give science and technology back to the people. The same is true for drinking water systems. Why do we have lead in drinking water? 40 million people in this country drinking lead with water with unacceptable levels of lead. So you have all these mundane, disrepaired technologies that need the genius of the scientists and tech and engineers that we have in this country.
You know, with the bank bailouts, with the collapse of a lot of the major financial institutions, that seems to be, in a sense, in line of what you're talking about. You write a lot of just about the corporate takeover of America. And since that's been happening, have you seen reforms or what you would think of as real, vital reforms happening, at least for some of the greater corporations or financial institutions around us? Or is it kind of the same old for you?
Well, there are laws. I mean, the Sarbanes-Oxley to deal with the accounting shenanigans, that was a law that was passed. And, of course, there's the law, the Dodd-Frank law that dealt with the post-crash on Wall Street. There are problems. One is that they were peppered full of loopholes by the corporate lawyers who couldn't stop them from going through Congress, but they could weaken them. And a lot of money flowed, campaign money. The second problem is the enforcement budgets are not adequate. You don't have enough federal cops on the corporate crime beat. And the third problem, there aren't provisions that shift power to the consumer and investor victims so they can defend themselves, so they can file lawsuits, they file class actions, they can band together as investors to monitor the companies that they own so that these bosses don't run away with the company as they enrich themselves at the top. So, you know, it's a good step to begin with, but we have to have eternal vigilance when it comes to corporate crime law enforcement.
I'm curious, partially in the cultural arguments you're making in this book as well, and you mentioned in the first books that you put out about consumer safety, you said how that was an era in which things could get done, where a book like that could come out, and you could make changes in the culture around you. Do you fear that the current generation, let's say, of up and coming Americans in their 20s or 30s, that there's more of a sense of malaise right now, young people? There's less of a sense of activism or wanting to pursue causes?
Well, they spend too much time watching screens in virtual reality. If you spend 5, 6, 7, 8 hours a day, starting when you're 7, 8 years old, and watching screens and video games and television and the internet, you're not going to connect with real life in your neighborhood. You're not likely to want to go down to town meetings with your parents. You're not even going to converse maybe with your siblings. You might send a text message when you get up in the morning and tell your mommy or daddy what you want in the kitchen for breakfast. But that's what's happening, and that disintegrates any kind of budding civic life. Then these youngsters go to the schools, and it's largely memorization, regurgitation to vegetation. They don't get civic skills. They don't get civic experiences between classroom and community, so they can study town hall, study how the water is purified, drinking water system, study the ecology, study the health care systems. No, what they're doing is looking at screens at a very, very young age and learning computer skills. They're not learning civic skills. Now, once they graduate high school and college, they become voting citizens, and they don't have a clue on how to mobilize themselves and their neighbors. So they get discouraged. They implode on their own private life. Half of them don't even vote, even in presidential elections. They don't show up at town meetings. They don't show up even at local referendums. And the ones that do are confronted by either one dominant party in a gerrymandered district, Republican or Democrat, or two parties that are dialing for the same commercial campaign dollars and don't really offer them long overdue redirections to improve the citizen's life. That's the scene. Now, the book is written to address this feeling of discouragement, this feeling of powerlessness. Because what it does, it says to people, look, you can realize something that you may not realize. You have the power. The Constitution starts with we, the people. It does not start with we, the corporation. There's not even the word corporation or company in the entire Constitution. So why are we ruled by these big corporations? Corporations are chartered by the state governments. They're created by the state. And they were created 180 years ago to be our servants, not our masters. So we got to go back to our history and subordinate these corporations to the sovereignty of we, the people. Now, in saying to people, don't give up on yourself. Learn a few civic skills. Go to neighborhood meetings. Lock arms with people who agree with you. There's a huge consensus for certain specific change in this country. Big support for full Medicare for all. Everybody in, nobody out. Even a majority of doctors and nurses support this. We don't have it. It's not on the table. It's not discussed at presidential debates. There's a big support for living wage in this country. 30 million people are working between $7 and a quarter an hour, which is the federal minimum wage, and $10 an hour. They're making less than workers made in 1968, adjusted for inflation, because if the 1968 minimum wage was adjusted for inflation, it would be $10.50 now. So there's a huge consensus. One Zogby poll just came in. 70% of the people want a minimum wage, including Rick Santorum and, until earlier this year, Mitt Romney. So you see, and who doesn't want a tougher law and order on these corporate crimes, frauds, and abuse against Medicaid and Medicare and consumers? So this book is addressed to serious people who don't know what to do, but would do something with others to turn the Congress around and then turn the governments around and then redirect their tax dollars along lines that are long overdue, like converting our country to solar, renewable energy, and energy efficiency, with all the multiple benefits to the pocketbook, to posterity, to the environment, to worker safety that conversion involves. That's part of the science and technology for the people. So you can read this book and intersect into it any place you want. You might not want to work on speculation tax on Wall Street, but you might want to get your local school to teach children civic skills as part of the curriculum. You might not want to deal with national charters for giant corporations and rewrite the contract between these corporations and the people who created them through their governments, but you might want to tackle the violation of civil liberties in your community. Or you might want to organize congressional watchdog groups in your congressional district. All this is discussed. You've got great references at the end of this book. It's out in paperback. It's inexpensive. It can be discussed with your family. It can be discussed with your neighbors, your coworkers. It's a motivating book without being superficial. And it basically says to the American people, it's in your hands to turn your country around, to better your life for you and your children. And guess what? It's a lot easier than you think. It is a lot easier than you think. If people want to give it as a gift, they can go to 17solutions.com and get an autographed copy. 17solutions, spelled out, .com.
You have run for the presidency of the United States multiple times, and of course we're in the middle of that run right now, getting closer and closer. And why, for you, have you decided that you don't want to be a part of that game anymore? And it seems you're spending more time, for example, on a book like this.
Because unless people organize themselves, nothing is going to change. I mean, I know that's a cliche, but we've got to do more than turn it into an exhortation. We got to actually fill in the details. Show what people are doing around the country that needs to be spread all over the country, like building community economies, farmer-to-consumer marketplaces, democratically run credit unions, local renewable energy like wind energy, community health clinics that focus on prevention, try to get people to eat right, exercise, drop their addictions. That's where it's going to start. But the communication in this book is a lot easier than people think. They grow up feeling powerless, which means they exaggerate the power of the super rich and the corporations. And let me tell you, the super rich and the corporations don't have anywhere near the votes. that the rest of the people have. If I can convince people that it's a lot easier than they think, then they're going to try their hand at becoming an active and optimistic citizen.
Lastly, just thinking about the current times right now, are you worried that this book might also come off as kind of anti-technology, anti-modern, in the sense that we just saw huge demonstrations that were, some say, the result of social media, of these screens that you're talking about? Do you believe there's no real importance in any of that?
They're very important in telling people what's going on around their community and around the world, events and schedules, marches, new reports. But they're not that good at motivating people to show up at rallies, marches. I mean, the marches that we saw with Occupy around the country were tiny compared to the marches in the early 20th century or the marches in the 60s. So let's give the Internet its due. It's great to get information. It's great to find out what's going on in reality. But you still have to add that component of getting up off your chair and going down to where the action is, whether it's a courtroom, a city council, a precinct for voting, a rally or a march. Half of democracy is showing up. And we really have to get serious. There's far too much time in our country spent on entertainment and spectator sports. And the last chapter, by the way, is participatory sports, right down to unorganized sports in your garage, playing with your kids in basketball. It's very important that we decentralize initiatives and solutions right where people live, where they can start feeling that they're making a difference, so their morale goes up to make an even bigger difference. Our country is full of problems it doesn't deserve and full of solutions it doesn't apply. And that gap is the democracy gap. And only people, not corporations, only people are going to fill that democracy gap. And then they'll make corporations their servants, not their masters. That's what this book, 17 Solutions, is all about. There's a lot of stories in it, a lot of examples. It's clearly written, and we'd like it to be in the living rooms with people discussing it all over the United States.
Well, Ralph Nader, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jonathan.